today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Nick, you look a little tired, my friend. You feeling all right?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I feel like I just woke up from a dead sleep.
Oh, you mean like a zombie?
Yes, exactly.
so stupid.
Nice.
Hello, everyone. This is Mike Wagner, and I'm here with our friend
Nick Scalera.
Jim and Patrick are away today, and so we are your substitute teachers today. And today we are going to talk about an album by the Zombies called
Odyssey and Oracle.
And the reason we chose this topic was because this was an album that both of us actually discovered in the last 3-4 years or
right.
so. Yep. And we were kind of like, how in the heck did we miss this album for all these years? One of the hit songs off of there is Time of the Season, which, of course, I think everybody has heard, at least heard the song. But the rest of the album, I don't think I'd ever heard a song before I discovered it a couple, 3 or 4 years ago, which, by the way, shout out to a friend of the pod, Pat Francis, who does the Rock Solid podcast, where I heard it was that he had Rod Argent and Colin Blunstone, and I think some of the other members of the Zombies on his podcast. And it was a great episode. And I was like, oh my God, I love this. And how did you discover it?
It's so funny, Mike, because I discovered it through a podcast too, but it was a totally different scenario. I was listening to a podcast called S-Town, which was the sequel to Serial. I don't know if you remember Serial. It was a huge true crime podcast a number of years ago, and millions of downloads for that. And S-Town was the sequel to that, and Rose for Emily is the sort of play out song for that podcast. And I was like, that is a great song. It sounds weirdly familiar. Where is it from? And that started it. That started me down the rabbit hole of Odyssey and Oracle. As you have, Mike, I'd heard a couple of their hits, but did not really know this album existed.
Just a little bit of background. If you're not familiar with the Zombies, I think most listeners will have heard they had a couple of hits prior to this album. One is She's Not There, and another is a song called Tell Her No. She's Not There was a pretty big hit. I think Tell Her No is a little bit smaller of a hit. Both really great songs. I particularly love Tell Her No. This album was actually recorded in Abbey Road Studios in June of 67, which was right after the Beatles had completed Sgt. Pepper. And they were on a very tight budget, and so they were well rehearsed and recorded it on a tight budget, although it took a little bit of time because it was from they started in, June of 67, and they actually completed the album in November. So in those days, that's a long period of time. And then the album wasn't released until April of 1968, which is bizarre, right? I don't understand that, but anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and it's a deeper story than that because they had those couple of hits, I think, in 65, right? That was when...
That time, I don't remember.
Or something like that.
Yeah,
I think She's Not There was 65, and that was a huge hit. And then they just couldn't get any traction on anything in the intervening years. They had, I'd heard some of the, some interviews with the band and them saying that, the way music worked in the 60s was their engineers were like, just give me another She's Not There, give me another one of those. And every time they come with a song,
yep.
This engineer would try to make it sound like that, and it just was not working out, and they were getting no traction. And by the time they went into the studio in 67, a couple members of the band were pretty much barely getting by economically, and they were sort of there's some controversy over this. There's some sort of back and forth over who said what, but there was a general acknowledgement that this was going to be their swan song before they even went into the studio, that this was going to be their sort of one last big shot to do an album the way they wanted to do it.
And we'll talk a bit more about this, but they actually benefited from it being in Abbey Road Studios as well. They ended up with the Beatles engineers, and I'm sure we'll dig into that a little bit more. One of the interesting things about the album is that the title of the album is actually misspelled. And you want to tell that story, Nick? That's a really funny story.
Well, I know that they sort of, you know, they had a friend whose name was, I think, Ron Quirk. I think I have that name right. I know Quirk is the last name.
Terry Quirk.
You don't forget a last name like Quirk. But this guy was a great artist. And, you know, he was friends with the band. And he said, I'll do an album cover for you. And they went away and recorded. And they basically, the album was already sort of printed and ready to go. And they get the cover back. And they look at it. And they realize that it is spelled wrong. It is spelled O-D-E-S-S-E-Y in Oracle, right? So... But of course, they couldn't do anything about it. It was too late. So actually, at one point, Rod Argent made up a story to compensate for this misspelling, where he tried to say that basically that O-D-E, that the songs were a collection of odes. So it's ode, Issy, and Oracle.
And the funny bit is that Colin believed him for years.
Exactly right. There's this bizarre cover story that Rod Argent told forever. And didn't even inform members of his own band that this was a huge lie, that it was just a misspelling. But we know that now, and it's pretty funny to just kind of look at it. But It adds to this sort of odd appeal and charm of this record, because, you know, I would certainly recommend everyone to take a look at this album cover. It's extremely psychedelic and trippy. But again, it's one of the odd incongruities here, is that, like, the album isn't super psychedelic or trippy. I wouldn't put it out there with sort of like the most acid drip stuff of the era, but the cover sure looks like someone was on some major chemicals when they produced the cover.
It's definitely of the 60s.
Yes.
The other interesting thing about this album is, as we mentioned, they weren't really doing, they had some hits, but they didn't have a lot of traction otherwise. This album was actually self-financed by them, was it?
Yeah,
not?
And I believe the number I have heard quoted is £1,000, which... wasn't even a ton of money back then either. I mean, £1,000 to record an album. And but it is quite remarkable, getting back to the issue with Abbey Road, that, you know, they were not on EMI Records. They were a Decca band, I believe, before that.
Right. That's
and
true.
There had not been, and then they moved to CBS after that, but there had not been many non-EMI bands that got any time in Abbey Road, and I think they had a connection there, and they were able to sort of get their foot in the door, which was extremely fortuitous, as we will find out.
So let's sort of, what we're going to do is we're going to kind of fly over a couple of these songs, and the lead-off song is a song called Care of Cell 44, and it is just a fantastic song. Great piano intro. One of the things would be a really good thing to talk about right here is the use of the Mellotron.
Yes.
The Mellotron is used throughout the whole album, but is, of course, introduced in this song. And the Mellotron, the probably one of the most famous bits, in case you don't know what it is, it's like the first attempt at a synthesizer way back when. It had pre-recorded stuff like flutes and horns or whatever. And the most famous use of it is the beginning of Strawberry Fields that Paul plays at that. So... The Beatles had used it, obviously, on Strawberry Fields and on Pepper and other things. And it was just left there, and Rod Argent picked it up and used it all over the album. And it just sounds great. Love it.
It does. It's a huge... It's extremely fortuitous. I mean, there was clearly a lot of magic sort of mojo in that Mellotron that was sitting there.
Yep.
And when Rod Argent, who's a fabulous keyboard player. I mean, just phenomenal jazz inspired keyboard player, which brings a lot to the music. He really used that instrument in sort of a novel way. You know, in a sense, he was trying to replace orchestration, which, although the Beatles could afford a full orchestra, the Zombies on their $1,000 or £1,000 could not afford a live orchestra. But a Mellotron sort of, at least one of its selling points back in the day, is that you could kind of emulate an orchestra because it was a tape machine. It was, you pressed a key and it ran a piece of tape, a loop essentially, of an instrument that was recorded. But it's such an odd instrument. It's such an odd machine, because what you'll hear on Odyssey and Oracle, you'll hear it's really cool. It's very distinct, but it's also a limited thing. You know, when you press the key, it basically pulls a piece of, it runs a head across a tape, but there's a finite length of tape. And when it gets to the end, it just stops. So you cannot sustain a note forever on a Mellotron. And I think you'll hear this. It's one of the sort of the quirky, fantastic things about the instrument. You'll hear it, especially in Care of Cell 44. It's fantastic in that song. But you'll hear some points where it feels like a note sort of clips off, because that's just the way that instrument was. You know, you had to sort of move from key to key. But I love it. It really adds a lot of character to the music.
Yes,
for sure.
I absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. The other thing, when Nick and I were sort of messaging back and forth, when we were talking about doing this, is you'll notice the bass in this song too is just fantastic. And I don't know for sure, but I think it stands to reason is that McCartney during Sgt. Pepper, really, his bass sound was really vastly improved, and they did some studio tricks. And Jeff Emmerich, who was the guy that Paul McCartney worked with, was one of the engineers on Odyssey and Oracle, probably employed a lot of the same techniques. But that the bass throughout the album sounds fantastic.
It has to. I mean, there has to be a connection, because, you know, if you listen to how bass was recorded in the mid-60s, clearly, and Abbey Road, and with Paul McCartney and Jeff Emmerich, they figured out a way to really make bass boom out of these, you know, early stereo and mono records. And you hear that on Odyssey and Oracle. It just jumps out at you when the bass comes in, and it's really powerful, and it's just unlike a lot of the other albums that you hear from the era. So some more magic, some more of the Beatles magic, pixie dust that was.
The last thing, and we'll probably talk about this a lot, is Colin Blundstone's vocals are throughout the whole album are just fantastic. And the other thing we were talking about is they kind of bring him in and bring him out, and his voice is, Nick came up with a great word. It's got a haunting quality to it, but yet it's still warm and just a fantastic vocalist. I saw him live, I want to say 3, 4, or 5 years ago. Still sound great.
He does. And he's, you know, he works a lot with vocal coaches. He always has. And he's really, he's an artist with his voice. I mean, he's very serious about his vocal presentation. And he's a fascinating performer to watch. If you watch the sort of the way his mouth moves, it's just, you don't know how the sounds are coming out of that. It's really distinctive, really distinctive.
YouTube it. It's good fun. Okay. Before we listen, one last comment about this song. We're sort of covering a lot of things that we're going to revisit as we go through the other songs, but just one thing about, whenever I listen to the song, I'm like, what is this song about? it's like he's writing a song to somebody in prison and can't wait till that person in prison gets home. This is awesome.
Right.
And just one more thing I love about the vocals is like the phrasing is like, the save up all the train fare money. And it's like they really break them hard, and then they have the nice, then they have the, you know, wouldn't it be so nice? And it's like the phrasing and all this.
Oh,
is just
it's
great.
It's
so
fantastic. And also, you know, Colin Blundstone didn't shy away from singing in a British accent. I know that sounds weird, but there was a conscious effort by British bands in those days not to sound British. And Colin said, I'm going to sound the way I sound. I think you hear that.
It sounds great.
Yeah, you hear that accent coming out in the vocal phrasing of this. But it's really just a fantastic song. It's my favorite zombie song ever. I know we're talking a lot about this, but I think as an album opener, it's hard to top this. It is hard to top this. Right. You can give me any other examples you have from other albums. I mean, this one just really comes, it just comes burst right out of the speakers, you know, right when the needle drops.
Yeah.
The next song we're going to talk about is A Rose for Emily, which is the song that Nick spoke about earlier that is used in the podcast S-Town and Serial. Anything about this one,
Well,
Nick?
It's a very affecting song. I mean, it's right up there with Eleanor Rigby. It's about loneliness. I feel like it's a sadder song than Eleanor Rigby. I feel like this person's life is just completely wasted. And that's pretty sad. But of course, the music doesn't necessarily connote that. I mean, you'll hear this a lot in Odyssey and Oracle, some sort of like cheery, happy music with some pretty tough lyrics, like Carousel 44 we just talked about. Very upbeat song about someone in prison. And here we have, another example of that, a person whose life is sort of hopeless. And, you know, the S-Town podcast, which was a hugely successful podcast, I'm sure probably, attracted a lot of younger people to this song and to the qualities of this song, because the main character in S-Town was a similar person to Emily. He was a fellow who lived in the South and was sort of a lonely, misanthropic person who kind of lived a wasted life. And so it was a brilliant choice by the producers of S-Town to use this song.
The summer is here at last. The sky is overcast and no one brings a rose for Emily. She watches her flowers grow while lovers come and go to give each other roses from her tree, but not a rose for Emily. Emily, Emily, can't you see there's nothing you can do? There's loving everywhere but love for you. Her roses are fading now. She keeps her.
The next song we're going to talk about is Brief Candles, and this is glorious pop song, just fantastic. Once again, the bass, fantastic. Love this song. I don't know what else to say. I'm pretty simple. Like, I love this song. I'm good enough with that. Let's hear it. No, go ahead.
Oh my God. This song is one. This is a Chris White song, which is worth mentioning, that there were two big songwriters in the Zombies, right? There was Rod Argent and Chris White. Chris White was a bassist. And this song, there's a lot of literary references in this. You may or may not pick up in it, but apparently this was an Aldous Huxley title. And also this happened with Rose for Emily. It was a Faulkner title. And so both Chris and Rod said that like using titles was a good way to inspire a song lyric. So he started with this sort of title, A Brief Candle, and went on from there. It's sort of a song about memories of times past. But the words aren't so important to me. What kills me in this is the bass. There's this sort of brief vocal intro, and then the full band kicks in, and what you hear is these bass notes played way high up the neck, and it is absolutely not a rhythm instrument. It is a lead instrument in this song.
There she sits, her hands are held tight around her glass. She only needs to be alone. She knows this mood will pass. To realize that she was strong and he too weak to stay, and to realize that she is better off this way.
The next song we're going to talk about is called This Will Be Our Year. And actually, unlike you, Nick, I actually heard this song in Mad Men. And it was used in Mad Men. And I was like, this is a really good song. But because you're industrious and went and figured out what was there, I, of course, was like, oh, yeah, whatever, and moved on. And it didn't go figure out what it was to my, my loss. One thing we should talk about here, since we talked about them financing it, is there was a stereo mix versus a mono mix. And If you really are bored one day, according to Nick, you can go on to these audiophile sites and have people fight over which one is the better one and which pressing is the best. I think we saw Scott Park's name in there. That was really cool. I love this song. But one of the things that happened was when they went to do the mono mix, when they did the mix, they mixed the horns right into the mono mix. So there wasn't like a track with the mono with the horns on it. It was like mixed down and the horns were recorded at that time. And that was the final pressing. What they didn't know is they had to produce a stereo version. So they went to do the stereo. They didn't have the horns with it. So the ones that you normally hear of this version of this song is without the horns.
Yeah, that blew my mind. I didn't know there was another version out there. I've only heard the stereo version. You know, this is another great song. This is a song that is very hopeful. It's a very hopeful song. It's also extremely popular for weddings, which kind of makes sense to me, right? You always think when you're getting married, well, this is our year. It's a great sentiment, although from the perspective of the band, it couldn't have been farther from the truth, right? Because 1967, 68 certainly wasn't the Zombies' year. It was not their year.
Sun, and this will be our year. Took a long time to come. Don't let go of my hand now, the darkness has gone. This will be our year. Took a long time to come. And I won't forget the way you helped me up when I was down. And I won't forget the way you said, darling, I love you. You gave me faith to go. This will be our yet a long time to come.
The next song we're going to talk about is the second to last song on the album, and it's one of my favorites. It's called Friends of Mine, and there's a great, great story associated with this. A gentleman named Jim Rodford was the bass player for the Zombies on their touring band. Chris White, who was the original bassist, when the band got back together, he would play shows, you know, some of the time, but he didn't want to tour and be on the road, and they had a touring bass player, and his name was Jim Rodford. And when you listen to the song, the Zombies will list off many, many couples. And one of the couples that they list in this song is Gene and Jim, and the Jim is the Jim Rodford, who was later their bass player. Their son was the touring drummer for them, because the original drummer, same story as Chris, he didn't want to tour and all that anymore, was the drummer, which was really cool. And unfortunately, Jim passed away a couple years ago, but he was married to Gene up until the time of his passing. So it's really, really a sweet story.
Yeah, it's an interesting song. I mean, you know, it's another Chris White song. And we had talked a little bit about this before. They only had $1,000 to record this, £1,000 to record this. And so they had to be very efficient. The band really rehearsed these songs, got them down, and the idea was that they were going to record them quickly and so as not to use up too much time in Abbey Road. That was expensive. But they all say that they still had time for sort of serendipity and for discovery. And this was an example, because I guess at some point Rod had suggested that they did a version, and Rod said, let's speed it up. Let's try it faster. So they tried it faster. They thought it sounded good. But in order to fill some of that time, this idea came, you know, if we're talking about friends, why don't we actually name drop all our friends? Because that'll fit right into this sort of melody. We'll just like name all these people, Jules and Jim and whatever. And it goes on and on. It's pretty cool. Just a kind of a cool creative burst of energy that they got around that song.
When we're all in a crowd and you catch your eye and then you both smile, I feel so deep inside. And when I'm with her, she talks about you, the things that you say, the things that you do. It feels so good to know two people so in love, so in love. Friends of mine, they are friends of mine, and they've got something that's so hard to find. They are friends of mine.
stays outside. That's something to see. That's nothing to hide. And when I feel bad, when people disappoint me, that's when.
So, as we mentioned, the album was not a success when it came out. But what was really, really strange is that in 1969, Time of the Season became a hit. So let's sort of talk about the time after the release of the album up until Time of the Season.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting story. I mean, as we touched on earlier, they were all but decided, or at least some of the band had decided, that they were going to have to break up for financial reasons because they just weren't being successful. I mean, we have to sort of keep in mind that Chris White and Rod Argent were getting royalties because some of these songs sold around the world. Some of the older songs sold. So, but the other guys were not making any kind of money. And in fact, they were getting robbed blind on touring, which is something that happened back in that day quite a bit with sort of ruthless promoters. So the other guys in the band were just not making any money. And this was going to be their last shot. And I think there was some hope that it would do well, but it obviously didn't. It completely tanked. And, you know, the band sort of broke up soon after and just moved on to other things. In this interim period, with no band to support it, you know, the album was just lost in the shuffle. It became this sort of obscure relic for a couple of years where nothing was happening. But someone had the idea to put out Time of the Season, and it became this sort of smash hit. You know, when you sort of put this together with the economic difficulties, the sort of the lack of money they made touring, the bombing record sales, I mean, it's a sad story. This incredibly brilliant creative work was just sort of lost in the shuffle, and it sort of fell into obscurity until it started to get some traction again, like in the early 70s, weirdly enough. It has had a second life, and that second life has allowed the Zombies to sort of reform and tour around it. And I know, Mike, you've seen them as sort of come back around. So
yeah, it was really, really a lovely show. I mean, I just had a really great time. Well, excellent. That was really fun. So before we play out with the big hit, Time of the Season, feel free to reach out to Jim and Patrick through the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Instagrams. Open up the window and yell is always an option. And the Echo Park Jimmy party line, 612 something something
1984 something. Not out of order.
Google it, folks. Come on now. We can't do everything. We can't spoon feed you everything. Come on now. Anyway, as always, it's great. And if you have comments on Odyssey and Oracle, please feel free to share them with us. This is great, Nick. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
Thanks again, everybody. Thanks, Jim and Patrick, for letting us sit in. I'm Mike Wagner.
And I'm Nick Scalera.
And we'll talk to you guys soon.
It's the time of the season when love runs high. In this time, give it to me easy and let me try with pleasured hands to take you in the sun to promised lands, to show you everyone. It's the time of the season for love. What's your name? Who's your daddy?
Who's your daddy?
He rich. Is he rich like me? Has he taken us?
Zombie.
Zombie.
Zombie. Zombie. Zombie.